Okay, everybody, welcome to the final episode of the Super Erogatory for Riddles in the Dark. Today we are going to review the last four episodes of Riddles in the Dark. Actually, there's a fifth episode that hasn't been recorded yet, so we'll be doing a conundrum for that episode. But in the meantime, we're going to be reviewing the riddles from the last four episodes and also some of your comments. We can't fit everything in, but we're going to be covering some of your comments. And to start us off, I should probably tell you who you're listening to. This is Laura Burkholz, and I'm here with Corey Olson, the Tolkien professor. And Corey's going to start us off by talking a little bit about his MythCon experience.
That's right. Yes. Good morning. Some of you, I just returned from MythCon, the annual conference of the Mythopoeic Society, which was a lot of fun. It was, there were a lot of really great paper presentations. It was, it's always... Tolkien conferences, in general, are really neat because, sort of Tolkien... Well, I shouldn't call the Mythopoeic Society merely a Tolkien conference. The Mythopoeic Society focuses on, generally, on fantasy and science fiction, though with a heavy Tolkien bias. And they really sort of specialize in Inkling studies, so there was a good deal of discussion of C.S. Lewis and... some Charles Williams as well, and a very little bit of Owen Barfield, who never gets equal billing with the other Inklings. But anyway, it's always fun. You get to meet with some wonderful Tolkien scholars in a sort of small environment. I got to hang out with a bunch of Mythgard students, a couple of whom I'd never met before in person. So that was a lot of fun. So I really enjoyed the weekend. It was kind of crazy. It was located in Massachusetts, not far from my home. So I actually commuted rather than staying in the dorms down there at Wheaton College in Massachusetts, where it was being hosted this year. I just drove down from my house in extreme southern New Hampshire, which was nice, although it meant my getting home pretty late each night, so I'm still a little bit frazzled from being gone the weekend, but that's all right. That's all right. We actually did record a MythCon episode, a live from MythCon episode, which hasn't been posted yet to the podcast feed, but that should... we should be able to process that relatively soon. That one was a lot of fun because we were able to bring in a bunch of the scholars that were there. I chatted with Christine Larson and Carl Hostetter and Richard West, who was the guest of honor, the scholar guest of honor at MythCon this year. So that was, and we did with several of my Mythgard students and other attendees. We were just kind of discussing and reviewing many of the panels and things that we'd heard. So anyway, that was and I had a really good MythCon because I had my mind genuinely blown. Like my entire way of looking at one of my favorite books was completely altered at this MythCon. So it was pretty cool. With the work in question being C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, actually, because I learned about an unpublished chunk, about half of the preface of the Screwtape Letters, which he cut out of the preface before it was published. And what was in that unpublished preface was to me utterly mind-blowing. I'd just throw it out there. I know not everyone is going to be interested in this, but for those of you who are, you will have read C.S. Lewis's Time trilogy, or Space trilogy, I mean, and be familiar with the character of Ransom. The paragraph that he cut out of the preface included the explanation for how he, Lewis, got his hands on the Screwtape Letters, like how he got the letters from Screwtape. And he got them, they were originally written in Old Solar, and Ransom translated them for him. So that is.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that crazy? So in Lewis's initial conception,
yes,
the Screwtape Letters were part of the Space Trilogy world. And I was just like, I'm still, wow. My mind is still blown by that, thinking about the Screwtape Letters in the context of, you know, Bent Eldila and you know, Ransom in the, because he wrote it right before he wrote Perelandra, and I kind of knew that, but the idea that he actually was connecting those in that way has just really prompted me to look at Screwtape in a completely different way. So anyway, that was really cool. That was
and then
my favorite bit.
And also, Screwtape Letters is dedicated to J.R.R. Tolkien, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. And especially, so the combination of the fact that, it led me to understand that dedication in a completely new way,
yes.
because of course, Elwyn Ransom is like this pseudo-portrait of Tolkien, right? So he not only, in the initial draft, he not only dedicated the Screwtape Letters to Tolkien, but he also, like, basically, you know, sort of gave, like, fictional crypto credit to Tolkien for translating the letters for, you know, it was like sort of tantamount to, like, you know, sort of joking that Tolkien co-authored them with him. I mean, it's not that he was actually claiming that, but again, like, within the fictional frame. And it led me to wonder, I was talking with Serena Higgins about this at the conference, and, you know, she and I were both sort of speculating, it's, you know, we don't have any evidence, you know, we don't know any reason why he cut that out exactly. But we're kind of guessing that, perhaps Tolkien just said to him, like, would you please leave me the heck out of this?
Yeah. Because Tolkien did not approve of the Screwtape Letters.
No, exactly. And to see how thoroughly he was, like, dragging Tolkien in to the framework of the Screwtape Letters at the beginning, it was even funnier.
Yeah.
I mean, I always found the dedication to Tolkien funny because of that. But
yes, because Tolkien didn't approve of a layman sort of taking on these theological topics.
Right.
Is my understanding of his attitude towards that. So.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, it was fascinating.
And who presented that paper on that?
I'm trying to remember his last name. Brenton was his first name. He's a graduate student from Canada, and he is one of the contributors to Serena Higgins's Inklings in King Arthur book.
Oh, her Inklings volume.
Yeah. He's doing a thing on Arthur, Lewis and Arthur, and I am trying to. I've completely blanked on his last name. This is what happens when you, like, don't sleep.
Well,
we can
stick it in the notes.
Yeah. He has a blog too, which I would like to plug. Sorry, I found it. Yes, okay. His blog is called apilgriminnarnia.com. So if you go that you can find more information on that you can, you know, find his whole argument there on his blog, A Pilgrim in Narnia. His last name is Dickinson, Brenton Dickinson.
All right, great.
His blog.
Yeah,
is great,
I've gone to a couple MythCons myself, and had just a great time, and was really impressed at the quality of the papers that were given.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on all sorts of topics. I mean, there's Tolkien. There's a lot on the Inklings. There's stuff on modern fantasy. It's a great conference, and it's a lot of fun too.
Yeah. So anyway, that was fun. I had a good weekend. Yeah. Still kind of tired, but I had a good weekend. And let's talk about, it was funny, I just, I, you know, just tweeted before we started the announcement of this episode, and a couple of the people who went to MythCon with me just wrote me and are like, you're doing an episode already this morning? You're completely insane. But, oh yeah, Robert Brown says, opposite to my other conference interest, he's playing Lotro at the moment. And I have to say, Laura, yeah, I wanted to tell you about this too. The Turbine guys came and presented at MythCon also this year.
Oh, they did.
Yeah,
oh.
Like the creative leads now and artistic leads were there. And yeah. I have to tell you, I've had respect for Lotro for years, but actually hearing the guys who have been writing and, you know, basically doing the sub creating for Lotro, for, you know, for all these years, mm-hmm. You know, I was listening to Chris Pearson, who, you know, the one who describes himself as the chief lore monkey of Lord of the Rings Online. I'd had respect for them before, and I went from I have respect for Lotro to I am deeply impressed by Lotro. So I think the time is coming when I am going to have to break down, I think.
Ah, yes.
My resistance.
Well, I am,
yeah.
Unlike in a lot of other times I'm recording podcasts, I'm not playing Lotro at the moment. But I do play, I'm on the Landerville server in the Lonely Mountain Band Kinship, if anybody ever wants to join. So, yeah, the amount of lore knowledge in Lotro is just amazing. I mean, they can't really bring in stuff in the Silmarillion, but they definitely will bring in things that sort of, you know, make you realize they know about that.
Yeah.
You know, stuff from the appendices. It's really amazing. It's much more lore. It sticks much closer to the lore than the movies do.
It was very impressive. I mean, listening to Chris mm-hmm. talk, I mean, I was extremely impressed. I mean, you know, that guy knows the books as well as anybody I know. I mean, including myself. I don't know Tolkien's works better than he does. You know, I mean, like, I might have some different ideas from him about some things maybe, but, you know, the care that he takes and the detail, you know, the amount of work that they put into this, you know, the level of detail, they showed a slide of one of his, spreadsheets, you know, where he had done, like, all of the action of the Battle of Helm's Deep as it's depicted in the book, minute by minute, correlating all of the action in the different stages of the battle with, like, the atmospheric conditions that are described and everything, so that when they did the Battle of Helm's Deep in the game, they could have it flow, like, so, you know, so that, like, the atmospheric conditions are exactly what Tolkien described them, you know, when, like, Legolas kills Orc number 20, you know, for instance.
That's amazing. It's really
impressive. I mean, whatever else, you know, I'm not saying like everybody has to like Lotro, but, you know, you cannot say that they are not, you know, reading Tolkien's works very carefully and taking them very seriously. And the thought that they've put into, you know, they're very careful not to, you know, because they only have license to include stuff that is printed and included in The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings. They can't touch any of the other publications, which means not only the Silmarillion, but also Unfinished Tales. But they're very thoughtful about how to, you know, sort of include some of the themes and concepts of those other works without, you know, without transgressing the actual, you know, into that actual text. I was deeply impressed.
I should tell you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we'll have to get you into the game sometime, Corey. But what they've done with Helm's Deep is, you go through that battle stage by stage mm-hmm. as an active participant in it, and it is really it's just amazing what you know, how closely they've kept to the story while still having it be a game. You know, I mean, you still are killing orcs, and, you know, you've got your bow and all this other stuff, but you really do feel like you're in the middle of the action.
Yeah, Kim Wehrmeister says, I take forever to level in Lotro because I spend so much time exploring areas and appreciating the in-game nods to the lore. Yeah, I kind of suspect that, you know, when I play Lotro, Kim, it's, yeah, It's going to take a long time because not only that, but I'm going to want to like lecture my way through it. In fact, you know, Laura, I should tell you, I was already, I sort of suggested spontaneously, on Twitter. I was live tweeting the, you know, a bunch of the panels that I was attending, at MythCon this weekend. And I sort of spontaneously mentioned on Twitter during the WOTRO session that I was like, hey, you know, I'm starting to think that when Riddles in the Dark is done, you know, next year, maybe I should start a LOTRO series on the podcast.
That would be great.
You know, I'm thinking about it. I'm, you know, I tweeted that kind of off the cuff, but I've been thinking more about it.
Yeah, that would be great. And
yeah.
And just to give a little plug for MythMoot, we're going to be doing a LOTRO session at MythMoot coming up this year in right after the new year.
That's so, right. That's right. Yes.
And John DiBartolo and I are hoping to do another LOTRO session where we actually have got, you know, the computers there and we're introducing people to the game and some of the game mechanics.
Yes, and indeed, so, I am.
Yeah, that would be great.
I've been talking since these sessions. Chris and I have been talking about possibly even expanding the LOTRO sessions of at MythMoot. So yeah, no, it's definitely something that I am very interested. But we'll see. We'll see.
Well, I could talk about LOTRO for a while, so maybe we should get back to the Riddles in the Dark.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, yes, we do have, so this is, as Laura said, the final episode of Riddles in the Dark Supererogatory, because we are coming up to the end of the riddle game for the year. So we have two more episodes. Well, we have one more riddle episode to do in the main episodes, and then we're going to do our review episode at the very end of August, and we'll be closing the voting, so you will have to submit your official, final, irrevocable riddle guessing, set of riddle answers by somewhere around September 5th, I think is what we're going to be shooting for. So, so, you know, we'll be posting the form, you know, it'll be an online voting form that you'll be able to, you know, where you'll be able to submit all your answers and your votes and stuff. And that will be up after next week's, or not next week's, wait, yes, it's Monday. Our next episode, our final riddle episode will be on August 22nd. And the voting, the official voting will start from there and will last for a few weeks. So we're coming up to the end. So this is our final supererogatory. We're going to be, talking about people's comments. We're going to be looking forward a little bit. So this is be the first time on supererogatory that we're anticipating the main episodes, and looking ahead, towards our final topic a little bit, in our conundrum. So,
yeah, so I thought we'd start by just reviewing the last few riddles that haven't been gone over yet in the supererogatory. So, and basically I'm just going to go through the riddles real quickly and give my answer. We're not going to talk about them too much because we've got the review episode coming up, so we don't want to cut into the time that we're going to spend in the review episode going over the riddles.
Right.
Okay. So the first riddle, episode 3.11, I believe. How does the battle between the goblins and the three allied peoples, the men, elves, and dwarves, begin? And the answers are the allies are about to fight or are fighting when Gandalf stops them, warning that goblins have arrived, which is the book answer.
Right.
The allies are about to fight or are fighting and are stopped by someone other than Gandalf. The allies are about to fight, but they hear or see the arriving orc army before they start. The allies start fighting and the orcs attack in the middle of their fight. There is never an imminent threat of battle between the three future allies. So my answer for this is the book answer, A. Part of the reason for that is because I always prefer the book answer to any other answer when in doubt. And I think that would be quite dramatic too, if, you know, if Gandalf is the one that gets up and shouts out to everybody that the goblins are coming. You know, I think that would be a very dramatic scene. So, and Corey, I know you said D.
I did say D.
So you
D,
think
yeah.
they're actually going to. Now, the only difference I could see between A and D is that Gandalf is the one who stops them.
Right, exactly.
Is there more of a difference? Yeah.
No, the primary difference is they're fighting, and then, you know, the orcs just start attacking in the
just
middle.
Just start
of the
attacking.
Fight. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, you know, Gandalf.
I would love that.
Like, initial shots are fired in the book right before Gandalf jumps up and stops them in their tracks. That's basically A. You know, they're like charging. They're even charging towards each other, but then in the end, you know, they don't actually end up fighting. So I think that they are going to fight. It is my opinion, therefore, that, you know, that shot in the trailer of, you know, the dwarves charging in on their war sheep.
Yes.
Right?
On their war rams.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. That it's the elves that they're charging towards.
Okay.
That is my reading of that. That they're not charging towards orcs, but towards elves. But then the orcs are going to come in, and so it's going to be like the leaders of the armies rallying, you know, their people in different
yes.
directions and
against the common enemy.
Against the common enemy, yeah, yeah. So
yeah, I just like the idea of the dramatic, the drama of Gandalf actually being the one to do it.
So yeah, and you know the pyrotechnics that could be, you know, involved, you know, that because clearly, it, you know, Gandalf just sort of jumps up and shouts in the book, you know, and it's clearly mm-hmm. wouldn't happen that way. You know, he'd have to make some kind of pretty impressive show to get everybody's attention and stop a charging army in their tracks on screen. So I will say I can certainly see the temptation to do that, you know, to see Gandalf, mm-hmm. Gandalf the Grey uncloaked, you know, as he stops the armies in their tracks. That I could easily, that I could kind of see. I still don't expect it, but I could kind of see that.
Yeah. It would just be fun, I think. So.
Yeah, Kyle asks about the trailer. Kyle asks, you know, doesn't the trailer recommend A by showing Gandalf standing in front of an army? No, I don't think so, because I mean it's clearly during the siege stage, which means I expect that's before that's while they're parleying with Thorin, and therefore before the, you know, Dan and the dwarves arrive. So I actually that scene I don't think that does not really at all sway me one way or the other. As far as this particular question is concerned,
yeah.
Sorry, you're wanting to efficiently move on to the next one, which is a good idea.
Yes, I'm. But you know, I do have to say one other Lotro thing is that the dwarves ride on goats in Lotro.
Yeah.
That look a lot like those goats they're riding on in the trailer. So I thought that was an interesting little coincidence. But anyway,
it is.
Yeah, let's move on to the next one. And I want to move on to this because I just think it's interesting how the answers fall in this one. Which Erebor dwarves will live and which will die in the Battle of the Five Armies? Thorin, Fili, and Kili is the book answer. Thorin, Fili, Kili die, and one or more other dwarves die. Thorin dies, Fili and or Kili live, and all other dwarves live. Thorin lives, other dwarves may or may not die, or none of the above. And all of you said C. Thorin dies, Fili and or Kili live, and all the other dwarves live. But I am going to go with the book answer, because I think both Fili and Kili are going to die.
Okay.
So, now, And the reason I'm saying that is because that would be such a departure from the book. I mean, not that Peter Jackson isn't afraid to depart from the book somewhat, but if Feely or Keely live, they would be the ruler. They would be the king under the mountain instead of Dian.
Yep.
Yeah, and I just think that's too much of a departure from the book, and I don't think he's going to do that.
Yeah, the whole premise of my argument is that I do think that Feely's going to live and become king under the mountain. And I believe that what, you know, Peter Jackson would feel like he would accomplish in, you know, the satisfaction of the plot arcs of the films and, you know, sort of the satisfying ending of the story would be worth making that change. But you're absolutely right to say that it's a major change. And although it's very easy to say in a flippant fashion, well, Peter Jackson's changing the stories all over the place, so why would it? I think that that kind of change is much more rare than people give credit for. I mean,
I do too.
People still overlook the fact that, you know, the majority of the changes that people are always upset about are simply the fact that he is doing that thought experiment of looking at the Hobbit from the Lord of the Rings point of view. The number of things that he has actually just, you know, a character is described as doing or accomplishing something in the book, and like that action is given to something else, or the story goes in a completely different way. That doesn't happen all that often in the films. It's, you know, there's a lot of things that have been added, but there are very few things that have been, you know, many fewer than people expect. We could come up with some examples. But you're right, that kind of massive change to the story, it has not been a feature of the Hobbit films, despite their reputation.
True. Yeah, he's added some things like Azog.
Yeah.
But Azog is not a main character in any of the books, you know, I think that having Feely rule instead of Dian, that would be to me, that's a bigger change.
Right. So, right. Yeah. Nor did it change the plot. I mean, if you think about Bilbo and the dwarves, and you just like make a plot summary of what has happened in this film, it's the same as the book. Right. I mean, am I overlooking examples? Right. They have the unexpected party at Bag End. They set out. They meet the trolls, and you know the trolls which capture them, and they are turned into the trolls are turned into stone when Gandalf comes back at the last minute, and intercedes. Then they go to Rivendell where they counsel. You know, they get counsel and advice from Elrond, after which they set off. Cross the Misty Mountains, end up going inside the Misty Mountains unexpectedly, and are captured by the dwarves and rescued by Gandalf. And they, and then Gandalf kills the Great Goblin. Bilbo is separated, meets Gollum, finds the ring, has the riddle game, escapes Gollum, and meets up with them practically miraculously on the other side of the mountains. Mm-hmm. They are pursued by goblins and wargs and escape from burning trees by being carried off by the eagles. They end up at Beorn's house, where they are given assistance to the borders of Mirkwood. They travel through Mirkwood, which is long and difficult and perilous after parting from Gandalf, and they get captured by the elves, and they are set free by Bilbo, who bails them out in barrels, and they ride down the barrels to Lake Town. Mm-hmm. Where, I mean, it's nothing.
That's exactly the same.
It's exactly the plot of the book. They have not departed from the plot of the book in any way. Now, again, all of you guys, as I'm describing those things, you know, are able to think of lots of like, wait, but that was different, but they also did this, but the plot is the same, right? They haven't altered any of the fundamental plot events. Not a single fundamental plot event of the book to this point. In that sense, not in that sense of of changing the you know of just like, you know, changing any of those huge events. That's to me a pretty good argument.
Yeah, so that's one reason why I tend to pick the book answer, unless I can find a good reason to change it, is because I think, you know, I mean, obviously he has a great respect for the books. I think more so, as much grief as people give him,
yeah,
he has a lot more respect for the books than most directors who adapt books.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Yeah, that, yeah, I think is unquestionable, and yeah, certainly more than people give them credit for. And I've been saying this from the beginning, I find this to be so much more true of the Hobbit films than the Lord of the Rings. You know, the Hobbit films are throughout engaging with the books on a completely different level from the Lord of the Rings. You know, they completely abandoned the Lord of the Rings sort of themes and concepts at several points in the Lord of the Rings films.
Yes.
And, you know, and basically the assessment that I had at the end of the first movie still sort of remains the same. You know, I mean, like if I have to give like a one sentence reaction, you know, I'll generally say, you know, the Lord of the Rings films were better movies than the Hobbit movies, but the Hobbit movies are treat the texts much more carefully and much more interestingly. Still think that's really true.
I have to say, I actually am enjoying the Hobbit movies more than I enjoyed the Lord of the Rings movies.
Well, I certainly am, for that reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe for that reason, because I had a hard time letting go of some of the themes that I loved in the Lord of the Rings books that really were not part of the movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yep. Yep.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next one. Where will the deathbed conversion between Bilbo and Thorin
conversation
occur? Sorry.
Thorin may or may not have a deathbed conversion. But...
conversion. My Catholicism is coming out here, I guess. Goodness. Okay. A, in a tent in Dale. Book answer. B, on the battlefield. C, in the mountain. D, it doesn't take place. E, none of the above. And for once, I agreed with you, Corey.
Wow, that almost never happens.
That almost never happens, I know. And the reason I think it's going to take place in Erebor is because I think it would be much more dramatic, mm-hmm, for Thorin to die surrounded by all this gold that he, you know, that he was... made his life's dedication to get, and just the irony, I don't think is the right word, but the just the juxtaposition of all this gold and him dying, and, you know, finally him realizing that gold is not and I'm trying to think of his exact sentence as he dies, you know, that he would trade the gold for, I'm sure you know the exact, what he says exactly, Corey.
Yes.
What does he say about good cheer? And
yes.
If people would value good cheer. Right.
If more people valued
good food and cheer
and song,
above gold.
You know, and good cheer above hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world.
Yes. So I think that would make that line have a lot more emphasis if that took place.
Oh, yeah, I like that. I like that. To see him, on the one hand, being returned to the mountain and surrounding and being surrounded by his treasure. You could even see, like, you know, his companions saying, like, he would want to be in the mountain, right? You know, Balin saying, let's bring him into the mountain. And then have him look around at this and say, actually, this stuff isn't really what matters. I like that. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms. I was thinking chiefly of sort of the symbolism of his being, you know, dying in the mountain, like, you know, dying as king under the mountain. But I like that. I like that a lot, actually. That's good. See, so even when we agree, your, like, reason for voting with me was better than mine. So that was good.
Well, plus, since I'm not on the regular Riddles in the Dark episodes, I'm not part of the synergy of everybody voting for the same thing, having the same reasons.
Right.
So coming at it from a little different place.
Right.
So, okay. And then the last riddle, it's the penultimate riddle, I believe, because there's one more to go.
Yes, there's one more to come.
What is the attitude about the future in the Erebor region after the battle? A, they think that peace is here to stay, which is the book answer. B, everyone believes it is the beginning of times of war and they need to prepare. C, they recognize the possibility of war but are not making active preparations. D, there is a strong division of opinion. And E, none of the above. And in this one, we also agree about that.
Look at that.
This one. How about that? Yeah. You know, and I had a hard time deciding on this one what it was going to be. I didn't pick the book answer because I think, because the book answer is based, the book at the time was a standalone book with no Lord of the Rings. You know, in these movies, they've got to tie it in with the Lord of the Rings, you know, like
right.
you said. So I think there's got to be some foreshadowing of the war that's to come. And also, there's so much more of an orc presence in the Hobbit movies than there was in the book. That, you know, and there's more feeling of menace that's not just coming from Smaug. That I think there's going to be more of a feeling of, yeah, you know, that we've won the battle, but we haven't won the war.
Right.
So, yeah. But how much it's going to be, I don't know. I was kind of torn between B and C a little bit, between the two of them. But I think just to foreshadow the next movie, it's just a tie-in between, you know, are we calling it Episode 3 and Episode 4, like the Star Wars ones?
Right.
I think they're going to have to be preparing or at least thinking about the future.
Right.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I you know, I could see them playing it other ways. You know, it's not that I think that that's inescapable. You know, we could certainly have, because there's plenty of opportunity for dramatic irony. You know, we, the audience, know what's coming, you know, and it's possible that they'll play it, you know, in such a way that they don't see that, you know. But I do think it's going to happen.
Yeah. Okay, and that covers all of the riddles that have been done so far. So now we're going to move on to some comments from the listeners.
All right.
And this first one is from Tom Hillman. He says, after listening to Corey and Trish discussing the portrayal of Saruman and his final fall into evil in the latest supererogatory, it occurred to me that his fall could easily be tied to his first looking into the Palantir, as it is described in Appendix B under the date 3000. It reads, the shadow of Mordor lengthens. Saruman dares to use the Palantir of Orthanc, but becomes ensnared by Sauron, who has the Ithil Stone. He becomes a traitor to the council. Returning to Isengard after the Battle of Dol Guldur, Saruman reflects on a job well done, thinking that now his own search for the ring will have fewer impediments, and that his role in driving off Sauron will allay any suspicions the members of the White Council may have of his own ambitions. He specifically recalls Galadriel's attempt to have Gandalf lead the council and Gandalf's smoke rings. As he wonders what tools and strategies he might employ to locate the ring for himself, he spies the Palantir. He dares to look into it to search for the ring, but instead finds Sauron now back in Mordor and in possession of the Ithil Stone. Probably for the first time since Minas Ithil fell during his long absence from Mordor. They struggle. Saruman loses and is enslaved. This would all be quite cinematic and tie The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies to the Fellowship of the Ring. So, so what do you think about that? Do you think that that's going to take place in The Hobbit? Doesn't it seem like Saruman is looking into the Palantir kind of for the first time in the Lord of the Rings movies?
Well, I don't... I mean, I think it's pretty clear that he has been looking into it already by the time we meet him there. So the idea of him, you know, looking into the Palantir for the first time, pushing that back, you know, to earlier on would seems perfectly consistent. One thing that I would want to point out first is a possible misinterpretation, and I don't actually think, based on his description here, I don't actually think that Tom is misunderstanding this, but it's a passage which I think could be misunderstood, and I want to make sure to clear that up. That entry under the year 3000 in the Tale of Years, specifically about Saruman, dares to use the Palantir of Orthanc, but becomes ensnared by Sauron, who has the Ithilstone. He becomes a traitor to the Council. I could easily imagine people reading that and believing that that's when Saruman turns to evil, right? He becomes a traitor, you know, so basically he's like a good guy with good intentions, makes perhaps an unwise choice to look into the Palantir. But it's only when he's ensnared through the Palantir by Sauron that his mind is corrupted and he turns to evil. But he does not say he turns to evil. It says he becomes a traitor to the Council. It's pretty clear, the evidence is pretty clear, that Saruman had already been turning to evil in his heart before that. In fact, there are even implications that his motivations for Treebeard in the text implies that Saruman had probably already begun to go bad, way back when he first started living at Isengard. And there's an explicit reference in the Tale of Years earlier on, in the entry for 2851, so we're talking about 149 years before he looks into the Palantir for the first time. We have the White Council meets, Gandalf urges an attack on Dol Guldur, Saruman overrules him. Saruman begins to search near the Gladden Fields. And there's a footnote to Saruman overrules him, which says, it afterwards became clear that Saruman had then begun to desire to possess the One Ring himself, and he hoped that it might reveal itself, seeking its master, if Sauron were let be for a time. So it's explicit. And remember in the Council of Elrond, when Gandalf says that he was lulled by the words of Saruman about, you know, saying that the ring had long ago been rolled down the river to the sea. Saruman already... So he's been going bad. He's been seeking the One Ring for himself. He's been, in his heart, you know, a traitor to the cause of the Council for, you know, centuries before he looks into the Palantir for the first time. So when it says he becomes a traitor to the Council, Tolkien seems to mean that quite literally. He's never actually done anything to betray the Council. When he is when he's ensnared through the Palantir by Sauron, he reveals what the Council is doing to Sauron, and therefore becomes a traitor for the first time. Therefore, that doesn't mean, of course, that they couldn't depict, you know, him being ensnared, but, you know, sort of show him, you know, it's not to say they couldn't do it that way in the film, conceivably.
Yeah.
But, I wouldn't expect that. My biggest objection to Tom's sort of story here, which I quite like as a narrative, is that it's a lot of screen time. It's a lot of screen time for just Saruman in a film that's going to be pretty full of other things. Yeah. And it's hard for me to imagine them going to that kind of detail.
Yeah, spending a lot of time on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, and then the next comment we have is from B. Lovesy. I had an interesting thought come to mind while listening to one of the recent episodes of Riddles in the Dark. Professor Olson and the others often mention two possibilities for what the Nazgul are doing. One, scuba diving for the ring.
That's right.
Or two, setting up shop at Barad-dûr.
That's right.
Well, I would find it quite humorous to see the mighty Witch King of Angmar in scuba gear or with a carpenter's belt.
Or a maid's apron, which would be even better.
Yeah. The film seems to portray the breaking out of the Nazgul as a fairly recent event,
yeah.
Just like the darkening of Greenwood the Great, another sign that Sauron is rising. What if the Nazgul were leading an orc army towards Minas Ithil, Minas Morgul, and capturing it as the first step in Sauron's master plan? The city is depicted in the Lord of the Rings movies as an evil place outside of Mordor, so it has to fall at some point. And if the Nazgul are just now waking up, perhaps this is the time. I highly doubt that such a thing will be portrayed in this now 5-hour-long movie to properly cover everything, but it would be very interesting. Personally, I think there'll be a dull Guldur for the White Council to fight.
Yeah. Well, my primary objection to this argument is that it's much less funny than the other options. That's my primary objection. But he's right. We did not consider, you know, we did not consider the capture of Minas Morgul. And yes, of course, you know, careful book readers are swiftly going to object. But wait a second, the capture of Minas Morgul happened centuries before this. Well, yeah, but come on now, you know.
Like he said, Greenwood the Great has.
Exactly.
Is a recent event. So,
yeah. The way that this stuff all comes together, the way that the movies have mashed the time frame. And of course, I've spent a lot of time teasing Peter Jackson for the way in which people can travel very long distances in very short periods of time. I've been doing that so often that I've kind of distracted perhaps my own attention away from the much more significant compression of the overall historical time frame that he's done here. And I can understand the choice to do that for dramatic purposes. But for exactly that reason, Brandon's suggestion about Minas Morgul fits into that same kind of pattern. Now, he's certainly right. The idea of we're going to add another battle scene into the film. It's going to be the Battle of Dol Guldur, yeah. Followed by the Battle of Minas Morgul, followed by the Battle of Five Armies. That seems absurd. But, you know, I kind of like the idea. So in addition to having them go to Barad-dûr and, like, flip the big switch, like in, you know, Frankenstein's,
flip the eye switch.
Early Frankenstein films, like huge switches, right? And huge metal switches, you know, to turn on the eye. They could also, like, you know, we could see them plugging in the light system at Minas Morgul, and like that, like, weird greenish light kind of, you know, blinks into existence like a yep. fluorescent light. That could also happen. Mm-hmm. So even if we don't see a pitched battle at Minas Morgul, we could see them sweeping in, some Rangers of Ithilien running in fear, and then, you know, they plug in the light system. So,
yeah.
You know, it's possible.
Yeah, kind of like what they did with them coming into Bree.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, just, it doesn't have to be a long scene, but, that would be good, and that would also be kind of a nice tie-in to the Lord of the Rings, so because it shows that just because they've gotten rid of the dragon and the threat in the north for the time being, that the war is not won.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Now, Kyle, of course, is pointing out sort of the potential synergy of these first two comments, that if Sauron gets the Palantir from Minas Ithil, that would be, you know, it could possibly lead to a connection, you know, between mm-hmm. their arrival down there and, or even, you know, like the Ringwraiths bringing the Palantir to Sauron. Again, my chief objection to this, as with all of these things. It's just simply time. You know, it's a lot. It's a lot to try to do.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Well, Peter Jackson's just going to have to shoot another movie that's between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings.
Once again, we just come back to the fact that, you know, it is, it was a vain, you know, thing for him to attempt covering The Hobbit in only three films. You know, I mean, it's just...
That's right. That's right.
It's hard.
It's tough, I know. Okay. And then Sharon Hoff asks, could they possibly think to make the acquisition of the Arkenstone as a goal for Sauron? They have played up the power / ruling influence of the Arkenstone, and since Sauron can't get a hold of his ring, maybe he thinks the Arkenstone could give him an edge in a comeback. He seemingly had a hand in sending the orcs and the other henchmen out to intercept Thorin in the first place. This would explain why he would be sending orcs to Erebor. But now that I think about it, if Sauron wanted the Arkenstone, he could have gotten it from Smaug, unless we are disposed to think that Sauron didn't want to match wits with the dragon. So, you know, that's a good question. Why doesn't Sauron go after the Arkenstone? What is stopping him from trying to get the Arkenstone?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess my big problem here is, just as with everything else with the Arkenstone, I don't know how it works. I don't know what it does. Until I know that, I feel like I can't even really form an opinion as to who else would want it or for what reason.
Yeah, why would you want it? It's almost more like, in the book, it was more like a crown jewel or something like that.
Right.
You know, it didn't really have any properties of its own.
It's like a really big family heirloom.
Exactly. In the movie, they talk about it, you know, giving Thorin the right to rule almost.
Right.
As if it has more power of its own sake.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So, now, of course, the question is, when Thranduil talks about the Arkenstone granting to Thorin the right to rule, the question is, like, in what sense, of course, and to whom? If granting him the right to rule is a purely, like, you know, intra-dwarf thing, you know, if it's something that only other dwarves are going to care about, that it has some kind of symbolic or even supernatural effect, which is just like a dwarf thing, like it's like an in-house dwarf thing, right? Thorin's right to rule as king in Erebor, his reestablishment of the kingdom in Erebor, won't be official in the eyes of the other dwarves unless he has the Arkenstone. If that's what Thranduil means, and his words could mean that, right? Like, I know you can't really reestablish the kingdom of Erebor if you don't have the Arkenstone. Then, if that's the point of the Arkenstone, then what on earth good would it do to anybody else? I mean, it's not like, you know, the dwarves of the Iron Hills are going to be all like, oh, Sauron has the Arkenstone, so Sauron is king under the mountain, hooray, let's all go, like, follow Sauron. Obviously, that's not going to happen, right? So, so the Arkenstone would not be a focal point, other than the fact that it's very large and very shiny, wouldn't be a focal point for anybody else, any non-dwarves, because it would be, apart from its purely material value, irrelevant to anybody who isn't a dwarf. But
that's
if the
true.
Arkenstone,
although,
if it does have other powers...
Yeah, and Smaug seems to know all about the Arkenstone. I mean, yep. I don't know if he got that out of a captured dwarf or what, but he seems to know about it. He seems to know where it is, too. But it could be, you know, Sauron could just be not interested in Erebor either. You know?
Well, the one thing that you know, Sharon's comment is making me remember and kind of wonder about a little bit more is that really kind of puzzling thing that the captured orc said to Thranduil and Legolas about how, like, that that basically that they have been sent out, that apparently one of Sauron's objectives is to prevent Thorin from returning to the mountain. That they don't, you know, he wants to prevent Thorin's return. And the question would be, why? I mean, who cares? Why does he care at all? For what reason would Sauron consider Thorin's return to Erebor a big deal? You might say, oh, well, the restoration of the Kingdom of Erebor would be a big deal because it would totally change the strategic military situation in the northern part of Middle-earth. Well, yeah, but hang on, that's a lot of ifs. Right? That's not about Thorin returning to the mountain. Like, is Sauron going to be assuming that if Thorin returns to the mountain, he'll automatically kill Smaug? I mean, Smaug is still there, for crying out loud. If Thorin returns to the mountain, there's still pretty small odds that he gets rid of Smaug. Yes. So, you know, you'd think, let's just have Smaug kill him when he shows up would be a pretty good backup plan to sending out teams of orcs to try to stop him. So, not to mention he's got the whole army. So even if we say, okay, he's for some reason really fixated on preventing preventing Thorin from returning to the mountain. So he's first going to send out, assassin teams to try to kill him and prevent him from getting there. Then if he does get there, there's Smaug. And if Smaug fails, we're going to send this huge army under Azog marching up there just to mop up. If that's the case, then, seriously, what is the crisis? What does Sauron believe? I mean, basically, this would mean that Sauron is being more proactive in preventing Thorin from returning to Erebor than he was in preventing Frodo from getting to Mount Doom with the Ring of Power, you know? So,
that's right.
Why? And if the Arkenstone has some kind of non-purely dwarf-relevant power, it could possibly explain this, or if it... I don't know. And,
you know, the other thing is, if you think about the Silmarils, which everybody wanted, and Morgoth, you know, Sauron's boss, what did the Silmarils do other than look very pretty and were very bright and shiny? I mean, they didn't really do anything.
No, exactly. And this is why, this is why the references to the power of the Arkenstone or the reference to the divine right, you know, granting him the divine right to rule in the first film. That's why we were all like, what the heck's going on there, right? And then in the second film, when Thranduil says his piece about giving you the right to rule, we were all like, whoa, okay. Because, yeah, if it hadn't been for that, if it hadn't been for the way they're building it up in the films, a little bit in the first film, much more so in the second film, I would never even have suspected that. I would have just expected it to be a really, really beautiful, big, shiny jewel, just like the Silmarils, as you say. But it's apparently more than that. But how much more than that, and more than that in what sense? I don't know. I mean, Gabrielle says very sensibly... Gabrielle Wilson, that she says, I don't think that even if Sauron had the Arkenstone, that the dwarves, wouldn't rally him. That is to Thorin. It is a little hard to imagine Thorin standing in Erebor, fighting the dragon and besieged by orcs, saying to his kinsmen, "I, the heir of Durin, have returned to Erebor, and I call upon my kindred to help me." And they're like, "Excuse me, do you have the Arkenstone?" Didn't think so. Never mind. You're on your own, dude. It's a little hard to imagine them. We know that they wouldn't help at the beginning, right? But it's one thing to say, we shall not join you on what appears to us to be a mad and pointless quest. And to say, our kinsman and rightful lord, has returned to Erebor and is in trouble, we're going to ignore him. But I don't know. I mean, this is all of this stuff just seems like I have no idea, because it all hinges upon what the Arkenstone really does. And I really just don't know. And so not knowing that, it might be a symbol. Yeah. It might be, it might have purely dwarf related power or significance. Or it might have some kind of actual potency, which would be useful to other people. I don't know.
Yeah, it's almost like a crown, I mean,
right.
People stealing the actual crown, does that give someone the right to rule if they're wearing the crown?
Right. Yeah.
Right. I wonder how much they'll explain of that, about the Arkenstone, if they'll address that anymore, if they'll just kind of leave it.
Right, like the idea of you know, Bilbo claiming the throne because he's got the Arkenstone in his pocket, right? I mean,
that's right. Hey, I've got the Arkenstone.
It's just kind of silly.
Oh, to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to our final comment, actually, from Adam. Listening to the Comic-Con trailer episode, I was surprised no one seemed to mention what to me seemed like some other quite likely reasons for the chariot. So he's talking about the dwarf chariot that we see in the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
The chariot seems to contain Dwalin, Balin, and at least one of the other young ones, possibly more. On the clip shown, the intent is also to get away from the mountain, not to it.
Yes.
They are being attacked by wargs, in effect, creating a micro-siege before the main one, preventing completely free movement out of the mountain. When you consider their pre-armor costumes, this therefore looks like an attempt to get some dwarves a message out of the mountain before the main siege begins.
Yeah.
This creates two likely scenarios for me. The first is that Feely, Keely, Oin, Bofur's escape from Lake Town will end up being seen by the wargs and then being shadowed on their journey there by them. This means that the chariot could be a rescue attempt by Balin Dwalin going out in an old chariot from the armory to rescue the returning dwarves from their warg pursuers. Secondly, perhaps a warg pack or goblin scouts, who, after all, were so close on their tail to Lake Town, will follow the dwarves up to the mountain in some fashion, perhaps not tailing the group of four. In this instance, the chariot from the old armory is being used to take the place of Roach and get a message out of the mountain to Dian down the old frozen riverbed. Bad news for Roach. Either way, the goats must be rounded up from the hillside. Yeah, when I saw that part of the trailer, the first thing I thought was, how did they get goats who were trained to pull a sled from, you know, to pull the chariot? Where did those goats come from? But beside that, you know, it's an awful long way to the Iron Mountain from the Lonely Mountain. So if they're going all that way, of course, on the other hand, we're talking about Peter Jackson universe where things are much closer.
Right. Yeah.
So, but you know, if they're going out to rescue Feely and Keely and Oin and Bofur, they've got to know they're out there. So I suppose they could see them from the top of the mountain, and maybe they're just, you know, going out for a quick rescue. But it seems like if they're that close, they wouldn't bother with the chariot.
Yes. Well, yeah. There are two reasons why I find both of these explanations unsatisfying. They're not two reasons for each one. I'll come in again. There are two reasons why I find the first one unsatisfying. That is that they're going out to rescue and or assist, you know, the Lake Town dwarves in their return. And the main reasons for that are that we see what appears to be the four Lake Town dwarves returning to Erebor in two separate shots in that trailer. And they're only the four of them. It's not eight of them returning. It's just the four. And eight of them would have to be all coming back at once. We see what appears to be four dwarves, which looks suspiciously like the Erebor dwarves, climbing through Erebor themselves, searching, you know, like going to or searching for Thorin. And we see them entering the gate as well. So that's one reason. Those are the two reasons why I don't think they could be going out to help to bring them in. I also don't think that they're going out to warn Dan in lieu of Roach, not only because, please, as if they would demote Roach in such a fashion, but my other reason, perhaps less substantive, for believing that is that it doesn't make any sense. They wouldn't be marching out in armor. You know, again, in that great scene in the trailer with Thorin on the one side and Bilbo on the other side, you know, all the dwarves are clearly preparing to march into battle, and the Battle of Five Armies together. If, you know, Dwalin and Balin if they all go to, ride a chariot out to go find Dan and return on sheep, then they wouldn't be there riding out of the gate with Thorin. And I'd have to watch it again, but wasn't, at least, I know we saw Feely and Keely. We saw Beaufort. Yeah, no, we saw Beaufort and Feely and Keely, because Beaufort was still wearing his floppy hat instead of a helmet.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to go look through it more carefully to see if we see any of those dwarves that were in the chariot in armor, in the battle armor there at the end.
Yes,
Because if we did, they're surely not going to ride a chariot out, talk to Dan, and then somehow get back. I mean, they'd have to ride into battle with Dan if that happened. And
yes,
it doesn't look like, I mean, I don't know, maybe, man, that might be what happens. But I'd be a little sore. But here's the weak point of my just like being a naysayer of both of those interpretations is that I have no further interpretation. Like I have no explanation of, no alternative explanation for how it could happen.
Could they just be going out to battle?
No, they can't be, because they're not. The lighting isn't right, and their armor isn't right. I mean, yeah. I am still, I'm just basically in a holding pattern awaiting further data before I spend too much time thinking about it, because there are several things, right? We saw what appears to be an attack by Bolg, and presumably he does not go alone, on Ravenhill, right? So we see Bilbo and the other dwarves up on Ravenhill, and we see Bolg on Ravenhill. So we mm-hmm. see Bolg striving with the Ravenhill watchtower in the background. When does that happen? Under what circumstances does that happen? Is it in the battle? I don't think so, based upon, again, their what appears to be their lack of armor in, like, Kiwi's glamour shot with him whipping his hair around, in that one moment in the trailer. I don't know. So we've got an encounter with Bolg on Ravenhill. We've got the chariot ride down the hill. I have no idea where those two events fall in the plot sequence of this story, and how they fit into the events leading up to the Battle of Five Armies, or if they could be a part in some sense of the Battle of Five Armies. I don't know. I feel like I don't have a good explanation for those things. I certainly agree that it seems separate. I don't think that that's part of the Battle of Five Armies battle sequence. But I don't know what else it would be. One other thing. Okay, here's one theory, but it's a completely unfounded theory. Well, not totally. It's founded on the books. Remember, there is a moment in the books after mm-hmm. the siege begins or is about to begin when the dwarves send out a sortie to get their stores from the shores of the lake. Remember, they didn't bring everything with them up to the mountain. They left a supply of goods down by so that they could withstand the siege. Maybe that's what the chariot thing is about. Is they're going out, and that's why they have the chariot, which also is like a big wagon, to haul the goods back. So they need food, because they didn't bring much food with them into the mountain. So they need to withstand the siege. Hey, I like this theory. So Jackson is going to keep that scene where they send a party of the dwarves out to bring back food to prepare for the siege. But of course, since it's the Jackson movie, we can't just do that. It's kind of uneventful in the published Hobbit, right? Where they go out and then they bring it back and they round up some of their ponies. So they're rounding up sheep instead, you see. And then they bring the supplies back. So they're able to last the siege for a little while. Since it's a Jackson movie, we'd add an action sequence into that, right? And there would be, some of Bolg's orcs and wargs getting in the way and patrolling around. And so I could totally see this. This works for me. But
yeah, it seems like it seems like a little superfluous, though. I mean,
yeah,
you know.
But this is my problem with it. Looking at the trailer. I mean, like there are all these like Lonely Mountain related sequences, which I don't get.
I'm looking through a little a slideshow from the trailer, and I don't see any of those particular dwarves in armor in any of the shots. Of course, that doesn't prove anything. There's nothing. I'm looking at the Swore chariot, and yeah, it looks like they're coming up on Dale. You can kind of see. I think it's Dale in the background. The ruins of Dale. Well, anyway, yeah, it's. I don't know. I don't have a good answer for it either. Maybe in subsequent trailers, there'll be a little more of an explanation. But
yeah.
But like you said, it's an action sequence for the sake of having a cool action sequence.
Right.
You know, most likely, and hopefully it'll move the plot forward a little bit too. So, but I think I'm going to go on a limb, and my guess would be they are going out to try to get word out to Dian.
Right.
So I'm going to say in the lack of any evidence for anything else plausible, I think that's what I'm going to say. So. But where they got the goats, that's what I want to know. That's my burning question. Where did the goats come from? I mean, you can't just round up a bunch of wild goats and have them pull in a chariot. But anyway.
Yeah, if we end up replacing ravens with goats, I'm going to be pretty upset. You know, if we have a scene, instead of having the scene with Roach and Balin, we get a scene with Balin and a goat.
Yeah.
You know, where Balin is like, ah, these goats were tamed to the hand of my fathers. Like, they surely will remember our old connection. Like, I'm gonna be
very upset.
Pretty ticked.
Well, and that brings us to our first conundrum. And this is tied into the show 11 from season 3.
Right.
Will Roach show up in the flesh or in the feathers, as it were? And I am going to say no. I am going to say I don't think we're going to see Roach.
Heresy.
You know, it's not up to me. If I was directing the movie, Roach would definitely be in there. But I just don't think they're going to... Well, first of all, they've cut out the thrush, right? I mean, they've already cut out one bird roll. Well, yeah,
there.
He was knocking, but he doesn't fly into Lake Town and tell Bard about the chink in the armor of the dragon. So they've already cut out one bird roll. So I'm thinking they're going to do away with the other bird roll as well. So. I know, it's too bad, but yeah, I'm thinking instead of Roach, they send the dwarves out in their goat chariot.
I don't buy it.
More action.
I don't buy it. We will certainly see Roach in the flesh. The answer is clearly yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. There can be no further discussion on this point.
So we shouldn't even do the poll on this one, because there can be no further discussion.
No, we can't, you know, this...
People can be wrong if they want to, right?
Well, exactly. You know, you can't stop people from being wrong about this kind of thing, but, yeah. We can let people vote, you know.
All right. So, I've put up the poll here. So Corey's argument is just that it has to be that way.
It has to be that way. That's my argument. Yes, you've done full justice to my argument. It has to be that there's like a manifest destiny for Roach in film 3. They couldn't possibly cut out the best character in the whole like last quarter of the book. Not going to happen. Yep.
Oh, people, yeah, and it seems like people are going to agree with you. Yeah, I think I think it would be nice if they had Roach, but I think they're going to replace him with goats. Yep.
With goats.
Goats, yeah. Barreling down a frozen river, trying to get away from wargs and pulling a goat chariot.
That is no consolation. Goats are not good enough.
Goats are not good enough. Okay. No.
I will not be satisfied with goats. So here we can close the poll. We have a nice, even... two-thirds of you believe, share my touching faith in the presence of Roach, and one-third of you are doubters.
Traitors to the cause. Yeah. That's right.
Doubters. Kristen here trying to respond to me with, cold, hard, implacable logic. Kristen Houck says, I'm sorry I can't see Jackson spending screen time on non-combat animals. Well, to which my response is, I think that you are doubly underestimating Roach then. But, Chuck asks, if a raven shows up in a non-speaking role, does that count as yes? If a raven just, flies across the screen or something, no. I think rather than being placated by that, I will be antagonized by that. It's like they will be taunting me with Roach and yet depriving me of his character. If Roach is there in a non-speaking role, okay. But they have to identify him. You know, they have to be like, this is one of the ravens of my people, even if Balin can understand him like Radagast can understand, the birds that poop on his face, then okay. that would be all right. I would be a little placated by that. I still would find it insufficiently awesome. It would be not nearly as good as it could be. But that would still count as Roach being there. But if all we get is Easter egg ravens, flying through at one point, I would say no. So... Now, Brian Biggs does point out that we got Bill the Pony, so it's not like there's no precedent for non-combat animals.
Yeah, but Bill the Pony played a much larger and more emotional role in the film.
Bigger than Roach?
Yeah, I would have to say a little bit. Bill the Pony played on our heartstrings a little more than Roach did.
Although it
would be very touching to have Roach and Balin.
Bill the Pony is not a king's counselor, it's... I love Bill the Pony too, but, Bill the Pony never said to a monarch, I shall not say whether this council be bad or good. I mean, come on. Right.
Well, do we have any other talking animals in The Hobbit?
No. I mean, not left. Okay. We've already passed by the. I mean, and it's pretty clear by now that that just having animals speaking, having Narnia style English speaking animals, that he's not going that direction. Yeah. However, Roach is different. Ravens do talk. I would be fine if Roach doesn't. He doesn't have to get all of his lines from the book, but he could still speak. Even if he speaks, like a parrot, I'd be fine. It wouldn't be optimal, but I'd be okay.
Maybe it should be Roach the parrot.
No. He wouldn't have to be a parrot. That would be absurd. No. He's because ravens can talk. Real live ravens can talk. Can be trained to speak.
They can.
Parrots can be trained.
That's
to speak.
True.
Like I said, even if he just speaks in that way.
We'll see.
Yeah.
So, we'll We'll have to take bets before going in the theater, and at that time, whoever wins is going to have to jump up and say yes.
Exactly. I'll be excited. Now let's see. Brian. Okay. Brian adds, if we don't get Roach, I'll still be less disappointed than when we didn't get the fox in the Fellowship. You know, I have to say, Brian, if you were really holding out for the thinking fox, like, you went into that film with some pretty darn unrealistic expectations, I have to tell you. You know,
I was disappointed. I'm always disappointed at stuff like that. But, you know, and we didn't get the, in Beorn's house, we didn't get the animals there.
Yep. Either. We did not get, yeah. I mean, there were animals, we but yeah, there. We didn't get the, we didn't
they
get
weren't
the,
serving
the
them
dog,
dinner.
The serving dogs yeah. and the other, the, yeah. The bestial wait staff didn't show up.
Exactly. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm thinking no. But anyway. Okay. To move on to the next conundrum.
All right.
For episode 12, will Tariel die with Keeley? Mm-hmm. I.e. the same engagement, same place, same time. And I am thinking yes, because that would be very dramatic. I mean, that would fit their story arc.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Agreed. And what's more, my suggestion, indeed, I shall even say my hope, is that they not only die together, but that their death is meaningful.
Yes.
What I liked, you know, the reason that I was prepared to defend the Toriel-Kiwi relationship, which I totally, it's really easy to laugh it off as just like an absurd Hollywood addition, you know, to be like, let's add a love story because there's no love story in The Hobbit. So let's add a love story. And I totally get that. And the idea of an elf-dwarf love story has even more comic value on the surface, you know. So again, I can totally understand people's, you know, initial reaction to sort of shrug it off. But what I like about it, if you can sort of repress your giggles briefly and kind of think it through, the role that it plays in the film is a really good one, in sort of showing people being willing to step outside the boundaries of prejudice, which are clearly getting in the way of elf-dwarf relations in that film. And again, in that way, they're parallel to the Baron Luthien relationship, even though it seems silly and it brings on a second fit of giggles to even utter that sentence, you know, that Toriel and Keeley are kind of like Baron and Luthien in that way. Thematically, they have some things in common there. Again, not identical in any sense. I'm not equating the two, but there are some thematic parallels between them. So if their death. I believe that they will die together, and I believe that their death will be sort of like helpful in the, you know, elves and dwarves getting along together movement.
Well, and it could be that Legolas witnesses that.
Yes.
And that could be, well, you know, at the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, he's still pretty anti-dwarf, but that could be sort of the start of his different feeling about dwarves. And also the Tariel-Keeley thing parallels a little bit the Gimli-Galadriel. I mean, it's not a romance, but Gimli does love her. So, you know, that's there. It's not completely unprecedented.
Yeah. I mean, the kind of reverence, and I mean, and again, people, it's easy to sort of make, to just sort of make jokes about that too. But don't forget, Gimli's love for Galadriel. I mean, yes, like, don't get me wrong, Galadriel and Gimli's relationship is a completely platonic relationship. I'm not trying to suggest anything to the contrary of that. But remember the scene when Gimli and Éomer are talking in The Return of the King, and they have what is instantly recognizable to anybody who has read Arthurian literature as a classic, like Sir Thomas Mowry debate about whose lady is fairest, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they're each willing to do battle on in defense of the proposition that, you know, the lady that they admire most, you know, that their ladies are the most fair. And, you know, and of course, Éomer is fighting for Arwen, willing to fight for Arwen, and Gimli is fighting for Galadriel. Now, neither one of those, of course, is an actual romantic sexual relationship, right? Éomer is not having an affair with Arwen, and Gimli is not having an affair with Galadriel. But that is, like, we are, that scene provides a kind of context. Like, they are both offering themselves as champions to defend the honor of their ladies. In fact, I've always thought that in that scene, Tolkien is kind of playing on that tradition. The idea that Éomer might fall in love with Arwen and there be some kind of, like, tragic love triangle. It's Lancelot and Guinevere. It's like a brief, near capitulation of the Arthurian situation, right? Except it turns out well, right? You know, he's not Lancelot. Éomer isn't Lancelot, and it turns out fine. But there is that, like, brief moment where it's like, whoa, that was kind of interesting, right? Yes.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of, you know, there's.
And it's interesting. They're both elven women that they're talking about.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't really know how it's going to work out with Legolas. I could see it going either way. I could see Legolas ending with kind of grudging respect, but still being, like, embittered. Or basically, I could see them not even focusing too much on the continuity, you know? I could see them kind of ditching, like, you know, I would not be shocked to see Legolas end up at the end of the third Hobbit film having a more or less, you know, pro-dwarf attitude, you know, have his character arc end up at having a change of heart towards the dwarves, despite the fact that that would be inconsistent with the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring. I could see them simply diverging from, because it's a pretty minor fact. The larger fact that it would seem to set up or anticipate the future friendship between him and Gimli might overshadow the minor fact that he happens to be anti-dwarf still at the beginning. So I don't know, I could easily imagine, like, Kiwi and Legolas having an exchange, like, while Kiwi is dying on the battlefield. Maybe Toriel dies first, or, you know, anyway, I mean, but however they do it, I do think they are going to die together.
Maybe Legolas inadvertently kills Kiwi and Toriel throws herself on her, or I don't know.
Oh, man.
There's all sorts of melodramatic things that hopefully won't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Legolas is like, oops, missed. I was totally aiming for that orc over there and just accidentally killed your little boyfriend. Oh, man. I really regret that. Yeah. Okay, so we have another two-thirds, one-third split. Two-thirds people say yes, one-third say no. That's a little higher on the nose than I expected. I got some naysayers there.
So the next conundrum is, will the Arkenstone be buried with Thorin? And the book answer, is the Arkenstone buried with Thorin in the book? I can't remember.
Yes.
Now.
Yes, he has the Arkenstone. So the Arkenstone is laid on his breast, and that's why Dan says, "Well, you know, he has the Arkenstone now, so we will honor, you know, his agreement."
So what do you think about that?
My initial thought on this was no, that, you know, given the greatly increased significance that they have given to the Arkenstone, that it would not be able to just be, because again, in the book, it was just a family heirloom, right? So like, you could bury the family heirloom with Thorin.
Yeah.
But if it's now got some kind of, you know, larger significance, you might not be able to. I mean, if it's like its power is necessary to help defend Erebor in some sense or in some way, then it'd be pretty dumb to bury it. Kim makes an excellent point.
And Kim says, My thought is that it depends on if Feely or Keely live. So if one of those live and it's an heirloom of the House of Durin, then they wouldn't bury it.
Yeah, I like that. So, I like the idea.
So if you're holding true to your earlier answer...
Shoot! Then, yes. Yes.
Then the logic might be... But see, the reason I think they're going to bury the Arkenstone with Thorin is because...
Sorry.
It could be...
Sorry, apologize. Go ahead.
Like a little bit.
Yep, sorry, go ahead.
The Arkenstone, they could blame some of the gold sickness or the dragon sickness on the Arkenstone.
Right.
And that would be why they would bury it. That would be why they want to get rid of it.
Right. Yeah. If it really is a corruptive influence, they could just be like, you know, it could be a part of establishing a new, you know, era.
Yeah.
Again, yeah, it's so much of it depends upon, so much of it depends upon, what it means, you know, what its power is or what its significance is. I do, because see, I'm dubious of the idea that it is connected to the corruption. We have primarily Smaug's testimony on that fact. The only objective thing which seems to me to suggest the fact that the Arkenstone has a corruptive influence is the kind of addict-like behavior that Thror was showing. You know, how he ran to get the Arkenstone when the dragon attacked and he was looking all not entirely rational as he did that. That's my only sort of wondering about whether or not the Arkenstone might actually have a negative impact. But, I think we'll... I'm going to go with no. No, they're not going to bury the Arkenstone with Thorin. I think they'll bury Orcrist with him, but not the Arkenstone.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm going a little more with my gut feeling that they will bury the Arkenstone. But like you say, it just all depends on this mystical power of the Arkenstone that we don't have any clear idea of. So, and it looks like for once the audience is going to agree with me.
Yeah, so a couple people haven't voted here.
a couple people haven't voted. And I think even if Feely or Keely live, it might be that they don't want the Arkenstone. It might be that they feel like it's tied in so closely with Thorin.
Right.
Because they're not direct descendants of Thorin. You know, they are his sister's children.
Right.
So they may want just to let that lie.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So let's see.
All right. So we have.
Okay. Next is now we're moving towards the end here. So we got the post battle. This is the conundrum associated with the episode we just recorded. The Return Journey episode. Will we see Bilbo at Rivendell in movie 3 on his way home? Or will they skip that scene and...
Skip Rivendell. I think we're going to see it because I think that there's going to be some discussions with Elrond as far as, Smaug is killed, but, you know, here's reality. We still have all this other stuff going on.
Yeah.
I think yes.
I mean, I do believe they're going to be pressed for time, you know, in the closing sequence. They're going to need to do the return journey. They're going to want to emphasize what happens with Bilbo's character, but I can't imagine we never even glimpse Rivendell on the way home.
Yeah, because in the book, to bring up the book again, that pesky book. That's the main part of his journey home. He stops at Bayern's house.
Yeah.
And then he stops in Rivendell.
Right.
So those are the two main things that we see.
Exactly. And what's more, the significance, I mean, there are several things that happen in Rivendell on the way home, including, most importantly, the elves singing two more songs. But
that's true.
but the other thing is that we get the reveal there of what Gandalf was up to when Bilbo is overhearing Gandalf's conversation. Not like he's snooping, but you know he's overhearing Gandalf's conversation with Elrond about the necromancer. Now I think Elrond is going. You know, I think I already voted that Elrond is going to show up at Dol Guldur, so it's not like he's going to need to be informed. But I kind of suspect that Rivendell is going to play that role. We'll talk about this a little bit in the next regular episode, I think. My suspicion is that Rivendell, there's going to need to be a moment where there's like a conversation between Gandalf and Bilbo about the ring. And I'm kind of thinking Rivendell might be it. But anyway, I do think we're going to see Rivendell. I do think it's going to make a theatrical cut.
Now, okay, I'm going to put an impromptu conundrum in here. Do you think the elves are going to sing in Rivendell?
Like, actually sing tra-la-la-lolly? Yeah.
Maybe not tra-la-la-lolly, but something. I can't remember what it is they sing on the way home. Did they sing tra-la-la-lolly again? Or
yes, that we get a reprise of tra-la-la-lolly at the end, and then we get the song that they sing under his window.
Yes,
when he's trying
to wakes
him
up. Yeah, maybe we'll get that one.
The "Sing all ye joyful, now sing all together" poem. The one which is, again, obviously a joke, like, sing we now softly in dreams, let us weave him, wind him in slumber, and there let us leave him. And they're waking him up by singing instead of sending him off to sleep. and he jokes with them, you know, by saying, your lullaby would waken a drunken goblin. I'll be a little surprised if they go out of their way to film that scene.
Maybe it won't be any of those songs, but something more like what Pippin sang.
I'm still hoping for music.
So wonderfully in the trailer.
Yeah. We got a little bit of music in Rivendell, you know, on the way there. Yep. No tra-la-la-lollies of any kind, really. But we got a little bit of music on the way there. I'm not without hope that we'll get a little bit of music, on the way back. But again, we have a pretty even 2/3, 1/3 split. 2/3 say yes, that we believe that we will get Rivendell, and 1/3 say no.
Okay. All right. So our very last conundrum, and this is for the episode that hasn't yet been recorded.
That's right.
I believe you're recording it this Friday.
This Friday? Next Friday.
Okay. Yep. Will we see the auction at Bag End in the theater version of the movie?
And the emphasis, of course,
as opposed to in the extended version.
That's right.
Yeah. I am going to say no, because I don't think they're going to have time to do that.
Absolutely.
And I think that that would take away a bit from Bilbo's character arc too. I mean, it would be a funny moment, but I really don't think they're going to do that. So,
I fully expect it.
You fully expect they're going to do it?
Absolutely.
Do you?
Absolutely. Okay. In fact, I am really, really, really hoping for a handwritten Burroughs, Burroughs, and Grub sign. Announcing the firm that is doing the auction. Yes.
Maybe Roark will do the auction.
Now you're just making fun of me. No.
Well, that's true.
No. I think the auction's going to happen.
You know, if they cannot do the Scouring of the Shire, they cannot do the auction.
But see, it's a false parallel. The Scouring
I
of the
know,
Shire.
I know. My there's no logic
time.
Involved.
You've got to build the whole thing. You know, they couldn't have done the Scouring of the Shire in under what, 15 minutes minimum? I mean, even if you did a small version of it and...
Oh,
and...
I'm just still feeling ripped off about that. So
I know,
I'm bitter.
But the auction could be done really easily. Like, they could spend 45 seconds on the auction. You know, like, even if we just got Bilbo coming over the rise and, like, the camera shows us a scene of, you know, hobbits, like, walking away with Bilbo's, you know, pairs of hobbits walking away with Bilbo's furniture carried between them and a big Burrows and Grub sign, and, you know, saying, you know, auction today, you know, selling off the effects of the late Bilbo Baggins. And then just, like, we turn and we get a classic Martin Freeman facial expression, you know, mm-hmm. as, like, Bilbo is looking at this happening. And then we just cut to, like, him in Bag End later on. You know, like, even if that's all we get, they could do that. They could do that in under 30 seconds. So,
yeah,
I think it's going to happen.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, I agree, as far as the impact on Bilbo's character arc, I need to think about how it will fit into Bilbo's character arc a little bit more. But that's going to be the main focus of conversation in the next episode, next Friday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where we'll be talking about really where... How the film is really going to be bringing Bilbo home, in the sense of his character trajectory in that way.
Yeah. Well, and it looks like once again the audience, and in fact it is a landslide.
Absolute landslide
for the auction.
Exactly.
It's not that I'm against the auction. I just don't think they're going to do it, but.
You're just kind of being a killjoy in this episode. That's all. No Roach, auction, no fun of any kind. Yeah.
No, I didn't. I think goats pulling a chariot full of dwarves is pretty fun. You know, that's fun.
It's kind of fun.
It's maybe not the same kind of fun.
Except, I bet you if that hadn't been in the trailer and we'd been like, do you think there's going to be a chariot full of dwarves being pulled by goats in this film? You'd be like, no, they're not going to do that.
True. So.
But then again, it's one of those things that I don't know, you know, I mean, you can chalk that up. It's not quite so high up as Bunny Sled on the list of things. If you'd asked me 6 months before it happened if they were going to do that, I would say, oh, I can't imagine they'd do something like that. So, you know.
You know what would be, you know, maybe they'll do the auction, but maybe they'll just, if we just get to see Lobelia, that would be great.
Yep.
Maybe Lobelia can have moved in to Bag End.
Yeah, exactly. See, I get think of how this could happen. You know, like we get the shots of people carrying furniture. We get Bilbo or Lobelia hears Bilbo come around the surface, and we see her immediately like put her hand behind her back, right? You know, with a case of his silver spoons in it. You know, which the audience can see, but he can't. I mean, you know, just the opportunity there and it could be so efficient. You know, we don't have to get a 5 minute scene of people making bids on stuff in the auction. You know, we just need a tableau,
need a shot,
a tableau of the auction happening and then a Martin Freeman's facial expression and we're good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe in the extended edition. So.
No way, man. Theatrical edition all the way.
Okay.
The extended edition will feature, you know, like a wrestling match as Bilbo goes after Lobelia trying to recover his spoons.
Oh, there you go. That'd be good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it seems that we have come to the end of our own little journey here on the Super Erogatories.
That's right. It's been really fun. You know, we've all through you know, we've been really appreciating the comments that people send in. I'm always interested to hear what people have to say. You guys often think of things that we don't and ask really good questions and raise really, really good concepts. So really grateful for all the participation people have had. I want to remind you that we still have our discussion forums that are up that you can access through the Riddles in the Dark page on Mythgard.org. So if you go there, you can still participate in that. Those discussions can be ongoing. So I would encourage you to take other, you know, the fact that this is our last supererogatory,
episode doesn't mean that you should stop making comments. You know, we will still be very interested in hearing those and seeing discussion continue. So
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So thanks very much, everybody. And our next Riddles in the Dark episode will happen on next Friday. Yeah, no, this is true. Sorry, I was just pausing for a second because I was doubting whether I was remembering correctly. But no, that's true. Next Friday, the 22nd of August is the plan for the next episode. So who knows? Something might happen between now and then, but that's at least currently the plan. So thanks for listening, and Godspeed.